to see so many folks on the screen. Some folks that I learned Talmud with last, oh, back in the summer of 2007, and other people who I've gotten to over the years at Hadar, and especially the folks who have been here in the living room with a cup of tea and everything else that we've been doing here in our neighborhood Gemara Shir, which has been great. But unfortunately, we haven't been able to meet in person. So our idea was, let's open up the living room a little bit and try to have a chance to do some Talmud learning with a broader group. As the description mentioned, a smaller group of us have been doing the third chapter of Sanhedrin. We almost got to the end. We have to schedule some catch-up sessions, but in that spirit, we're continuing on with the fourth chapter of Sanhedrin. Tonight, we're actually mostly going to do the whole Perek of Mishnah and a little bit of background that's required from Tanakh to understand what's going on, such that we'll be set up next week to be able to jump into the Gemara. And again, in terms of just sort of setting up expectations, what I tried to put in the description, we're going to be working off the original text. I will share tonight a Mishnah text, but otherwise just the page of the standard Vilna Shas. I strongly encourage you to have your own text in front of you, but I will have the text up on the screen. And we pretty much work off of the original, covering the core text, Rashi. I do a Tosfot every now and then. Sometimes I refer to things in scholarship or other things that are of interest. So it's not a kind of intro to Talmud class in that sense, and is good for people with some experience, but also totally appropriate for folks who are willing to jump in and be led by as good a guide as I can be. So we are we're in the middle of a masechet here. We're in the middle of really a discussion about judicial procedure. I'll just say very briefly something that we said when we started the third chapter, which is the rabbinic system of jurisprudence and what courts look like is always somewhere between a reconstruction of actual things that happened and a fantasy of what might and ought to be. That is particularly true when we get to Dinei Nefashot, which is what our chapter starts to get into, that is to say capital cases. Everything we know about the Roman Empire in the time of the Mishnah tells us that there is no possible way that they would have ceded any kind of capital authority to Jewish courts. So anything that's about here's how we actually execute people is not in any way based in a reality of what was actually happening, certainly in the first or second centuries. There are some memories that come up in the Talmud and other times of things that went on during the Maccabean period, and there's clearly some kind of sufficient independence that some degree of capital authority was being exercised. And as is always the case with rabbinic interpretations of biblical law, even if they are 100% right and 100% what was whispered in Moshe's ear, that does not guarantee that that is what all the Jews were doing. So you have the separate question even beyond, is this something they thought they ought to do? And then that is separate from the question of was this actually being done? Was there a compliant population or system? So we'll keep that in mind as we go through it and see what we come up with in terms of details that seem more real to us and more imagined. There's been some really interesting scholarship on the rabbinic death penalty. Beth Berkowitz has written a book around it. Dvorah Steinmetz does some important work. So for those who like to explore that kind of stuff, they've really thought through what are the values behind the rabbinic judicial system, particularly the imagined capital system. And I do think that's a helpful frame. The historical questions are interesting. Much more interesting is when you prescribe that this is the way a judicial procedure is supposed to look, what does that say about what you care about, which on some level is easier to zero in on than what actually may or may not have happened. Okay, so with that, we're going to jump into the Mishnah. Again, if you have your Gemara, you can open it, but we're not really going to use it that much tonight. You can look at it for the opening for the opening Mishnah, the Mishnah, but I'm going to take us through a text on the page that's going to take us through most of what we need to see. So we are in the fourth chapter, Mishnah 1. If you're on the page of the Talmud, it's Lamed Bet Amud Aleph, but again, that's not going to carry you all the way through unless you jump around. I have up here the Mishnah that I'll mostly be working on, though I'm going to jump to another page of biblical text. So yeah, the Perek, the name of the chapter is Echad Dinei Mamonot. Okay, the Mishnah begins. Echad dinei mamonot ve'echad dinei nefashot bidrisha uvachakira she'ne'emar mishpat echad yihye lachem. So both dinei mamonot, which we could translate as monetary law, maybe civil law, and dinei nefashot, capital cases, both of those cases share the factor of drisha and chakira, of having some kind of intensive investigation of the witnesses. Lest you think, well, what does drisha mean and what does hakira mean and are those two different categories? So what we'll see right now is really that is just the paraphrasing of a biblical text, v'darashta v'chakarta heitev, and in that sense is just a phrase that captures needing to do the inquiry of the case very carefully. Okay, to really make sure we've got the details right. And that is pegged to the verse, Mishpat Echad Yihye Lachem. So we're mostly going to stay in the Mishnah, but I'm going to jump now to another piece here that I want us to sort of have and understand as background. Mishpat Echad Yihye Lachem, which is the phrase the Mishnah is using to say, to ground the idea that there is no difference between civil and criminal procedure, okay? Mishpat echad yihye lachem. There is one set of procedural rules. Comes from a verse that we'll get to in a minute in Vayikra Perek Kaf Dalet, okay? But I want to start with a similar phrase, almost identical, except for a vav, that appears in Bamidbar Perek Tet Vav to get a sense of what's the real kind of shot of this, and nonetheless why Chazal read it in the way they're reading it in this Mishnah, and how that too represents actually a careful and accurate reading of the Torah. A lot of times we encounter Midrashim, and we think of it, Midrash is where the rabbis have a flight of fancy, and they can bend the text to their will and say whatever they want. That's generally, in my experience, a misunderstanding of Midrash. A proper understanding of Midrash is, here's how they are actually reading, maybe hypersensitively, but nonetheless sensitively. So if you go to Bamidbar Tetvav, Kol ha'ezrach ya'ase kacha et eila la'akriv yishereach nichoach l'adonai. So this is in the context of Parashat Nesachim. We're talking about the various libations that are brought with various korbanot, various sacrifices. So in Parshiyot Vayikra and Tzav, we get all the details of how you're supposed to bring various korbanot, but nothing is really laid out about Menachot and Nesachim, about the accompanying cereal and liquid offerings that come with those meat offerings. That gets laid out in Parshat Shlach. And after that's laid out, the Torah says every native-born Israelite should perform this, should bring these added offerings whenever they bring a fire offering to God. V'chi agur itchem ger, o asher betochachem ledorotichem, v'asa yisher reyach nichoach l'adonai, kasher ta'asu ken ya'aseh. Hakahal, chuka achat lachem velager hagar, chukat olam dorotechem, kachem, kager yihye, lifnei Adonai. And lest you think that the requirement, or maybe even the perk of bringing these added supplemental offerings is limited to the ezrach, to the native born, no. If a ger lives with you, biblically a non-Israelite who's resident in Israelite territory, later in rabbinic understanding, the convert who becomes resident in the non-territorial Israelite territory of the Jewish people, a ger also follows the same rule. There's one rule for you and for the ger that lives in your midst. That's a rule for all time. Kachem, kager, yihye. And then, Torah achat umishpat echad yihye lachem. Ve'lager, agar itchem. That line clearly means there's one rule and one procedure for you and the ger, the stranger, the convert, which is to say the plain sense of that phrase is equality before the law of all the people who live on the land, all the people who are Jewish, whether by birth or by conversion. Mishpat echad yihyeh lachem, there's not two classes of people. Okay, so how can you possibly use the phrase mishpat echad yihyeh lachem to mean what the Mishnah wants it to mean, which is consistency of procedure across judicial realms? So if you look at Vayikra Perek Kaf Dalet and you just jump to Pasuk Kaf Bet, mishpat echad yihyeh lachem, kager ka'ezrach yihyeh, ki ani Hashem Elokechem. That seems to mean the exact same thing as we saw above. Meaning, whatever is preceded, we're telling you, this has to be applied equally, both to the ger and to the ezrach. Okay? So that seems like it's even worse, right? How can this phrase possibly mean that? But if you look at the verses prior, you see something interesting. There's a collection of laws here, and let's pay attention to what they're talking about. So that is a capital case. If you murder someone, you have to be put to death. If you kill an animal, you have to pay for it. Now, literally, you might translate that life for life, but no one is suggesting that you are going to actually kill a human being for killing an animal. So here we see nefesh tachat nefesh means some kind of compensation. That is to say, it probably means something like if you killed the person's ox, you give them an ox, a living ox, in place of the ox that you killed. But however defined, this is not a capital case. The ishki yitein mumba mito kasher asa ken ye'aselo, shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, shen tachat shen, kasher yitein mumba adam ken yinaten bo. Here we have bodily injury. This is a tort. It's not a capital case, but it's also not just paying money for money lost in the same way. There's bodily damage, eye for an eye, so on and so forth. That is the next thing in the list. Then we go back to a general phrase, makeh vehema yishalmeno, makeh adam yumat. If you kill an animal, you pay for it. Whereas if you kill a person, you will be put to death. Mishpat echad yihyeh lachem. Now, that is not so unreasonably read in context there as saying, I just gave you a jumble of civil, criminal, tort cases, and I'm telling you, mishpat echad yihyeh lachem, where now you can see the rabbinic midrashic tradition is reading that as hinting at a uniformity of procedure. And then, kager ka'ezrach yihyeh can be read as, and that uniformity of procedure should also apply equally to the ger and to the ezrach. Now, I'm not saying they don't have an agenda or already have the idea that there's supposed to be some kind of uniformity of procedure, but I want us to appreciate how when the Mishnah quotes this verse, it is not just completely twisting it out of its original sense. Its context in Vayikra Kaf Dalet and the general rabbinic assumption that there is sort of parsimony of language in the Torah, and therefore, if I already have Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem in Bemidbar, the Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem in Vayikra should be telling me something different, produces actually a reasonably textually grounded reading of this idea, which is front and center in the Mishnah, which is that there is one procedure for civil and criminal. And in terms of that, and then I'll pause if there's a question or a comment, the main thing that the Mishnah is concerned about equalizing is this concept of Drisha V'Chakira, which comes here in this verse in Dvarim Yud Gimel, which is talking about the case of the Ir HaNidachat, a case of a city that goes completely over to idolatry and is sort of lost ideologically to the Jewish people. And before condemning that city to death, burning it to the ground, murdering everyone, executing everyone in it, which is the punishment for the Ir HaNidachat, the Torah says, well, yeah, but you better get it right. V'darashta v'chakarta v'sha'alta heitev. Conduct a very thorough inquiry. If you do that, v'hine emet nachon adavar, and it is true and correct what you have uncovered, then hake take, then go ahead and wipe them out. So the idea here is that the Torah already assigns drisha v'hakira, a very careful, probing, searching investigation of the evidence for capital cases. That's clear from the Ir HaNidachat case. Certainly reasonable to extend it to all capital cases before you execute people. Double check, triple check, quadruple check. And then the force of Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem is, lest you think you can be lazy with civil cases, you should apply the same rigor to investigating those. Now, some of the most interesting thing about our chapter, the next line in the Mishnah that we're going to get to, and a lot of our chapter, is going to be that entire principle is now going to be undermined bit by bit. But we begin, at least, with the principle that these two areas should be the same, and it's grounded in the reading of those various verses. Okay, any quick comments or questions on that before we go now into the Mishnah? That's sort of the Tanakh background here. So great, that's our introduction. And barring seeing anything coming up here, I'll give just one more second. Great, a few things here. Okay, great. So yeah, in terms of the question of darosh darash, rabbis are reading them as meaning the same thing. You mean reading darashta and chakarta as being the same? I mean, if that's what I take your question to be. So the idea is that yeah, there's not necessarily a deep division between darashta and chakarta, but we will see when we get into the Talmud how that's understood, what these categories are meant to get at. Okay. Great. So we do have a bridging of a gap that might otherwise be expected to be wide, but now we're going to actually dramatically open that back up again. All right, so let's go back to the Mishnah, which I'm going to put up here, and you can feel free to follow along. You know, if you prefer Safari or something else, feel free to jump in on that. Okay, so Echad dinei mamonot v'echad dinei nefashot b'drisha v'chakira sh'ne'emar mishpat echad yihyeh lachem. So they're exactly the same, except I didn't do a perfect count of it, except something like the next 10 things. Okay, so let's see what happens now. Ma bein dinei mamonot ledinei nefashot. So, well, at the end of the day, they are different. So what's different between them? Dinei mamonot bishlosha, v'dinei nefashot, v'esrim u'shlosha. Well, actually, civil monetary cases are tried by panels of 3, whereas capital cases are tried by panels of 23. Dinei mamonot potchin bein lizchut bein lechova, v'dinei nefashot potchin lizchut bein potchin lechova. When you have a civil case, you can begin the arguments in favor or against the person. In other words, a plaintiff is coming to get something from the defendant. The first argument out of the box can be in favor of the plaintiff, or it can be in favor of the defendant. Dinei nefashot, the first argument must always be in favor of the accused. You cannot begin with the argument from the prosecution. Moving forward, we're going to go through the whole long list here in the Mishnah. Next, dinei mamonot matin al pi echad bein lizchut bein lechova, v'dinei nefashot matin al pi echad lizchut ve'al pi shnayim lechova. Dinei mamonot can be decided by a one-vote margin, either for or against the defendant. The dinei nefashot can only be decided by a one-vote margin for acquittal. But conviction, like a game of tennis, can only be won by 2 points. Okay, that's the next point. Dinei mamonot, machzirin bein lizchut bein lechova. I mean, they did away with that because the games got too long, right? Now you have the tiebreaker in tennis when you get up to 6-6. But used to be, you could go on, and you'd have to go to 12-10 or something like that to win the set. Okay, the tennis fans among you know what I'm talking about. Dinei mamonot, machzirin bein lizchut bein lechova. Dinei nefashot, machzirin lizchut bein machzirin lechova. In civil cases, even after the case has been decided, you can pull it back into court. retry it in order to undo the verdict either way. All right, even if the defendant got off, if there's now new evidence that he owes money, so you can bring it back to court, and certainly you can bring it back with new evidence to let him off from having to pay. But dinei nefashot, you can only overturn a conviction, you cannot overturn an acquittal. Dinei mamonot, hakol melamdin zechut vechova, v'dinei nefashot, hakol melamdin zechut ve'en hakol melamdin chova. In dinei mamonot, anyone, and this would seem to be maybe anyone in the courtroom, can offer arguments in favor or against either of the litigants. Dinei nefashot, anyone, right, seemingly anyone in the courtroom can say, I've got something that I think will exonerate the person, but the right to present damning evidence is much more restricted. Mishnah doesn't lay out who that is. Dinei mamonot, hamelamed chova, melamed zechut, v'hamelamed zechut, melamed chova. Dinei nefashot, hamelamed chova, melamed zechut, aval hamelamed zechut, eino yachol lachzor lamed chova. In civil cases, everyone can switch back and forth. I presented this evidence yesterday, now I present this evidence today. This seems to be talking about the judges who are arguing out in some kind of oral argument fashion for, I think this, you know, should lead us to decide this way. And you can switch back and forth. It's just an open discussion. Dinei nefashot, once you have presented evidence for conviction, you can then present exonerating evidence. But once you have begun to exonerate, you cannot go back and provide any aggravating evidence against the defendant. Dinei mamonot, still feel like they're the same? Still feel like it's mishpat echad? Dinei mamonot, danin bayom vegomrim balayla. Dinei nefashot, danin bayom vegomrim bayom. So dinei mamonot, you can start it in the day. You have to start it in the day, but you can end up running late and finishing it at night. Dinei nefashot can only be finished in the day. We'll see actually what this means in a moment. In a clearer way, you basically cannot do it all in one shot. Okay, let's go on the next line. We'll see. Dinei mamonot gomrin bo vayom bein lizchut bein lechova. Dinei nefashot gomrin bo vayom lizchut uveyom shela acharav lechova. Lefichach ein danin lo ve'erev Shabbat velo be'erev Yom Tov. So, dinei mamonot, you can have a quick trial that begins that day and ends that very same day, and it can spill over to the night. You can basically say, we want this done. We called the, you know, the roll call vote at 2 p.m, but it took us until 1 a.m. To break the filibuster and get to the end of it. That's fine with dinei mamonot. Dinei nefashot, basically, not only can you not drag it out into the nighttime hours, but you are not allowed to finish it on the same day unless it is an exoneration. If you are going to convict someone, you must sleep on it. Okay, biyom shelach harav lechova, and therefore, you can never open a capital trial on Friday or on Erev Yom Tov, because you cannot conduct judicial proceedings on Shabbat and Yom Tov, and this added by later commentators, you cannot start it on Friday and then take a hiatus and come back on Sunday, because that is basically deemed to be sort of inappropriately putting off the judgment and the procedure. And so therefore, you have to start it at a day where you can follow up. So there's a question here, what does zechut and chova mean with reference to mamonot? So just to clarify here, right, that's, I tried to sort of fit that in. It seems to be at the end of the day with a dinei mamonot, there is someone trying to collect money from someone else. Someone's got the possession of something, whether it's the disputed loan or a field or something of that. And in that sense, chova in the dinei mamonot context is, I am presenting evidence that will cause you to have to pay. All right, so hopefully that that makes that a little bit clear. A couple other comments here, and then happy to take some others. Who initiates a suit for Dinei Nefeshot? Right. So Jed is pointing out implicitly in our world, that is the state, right? We have a DA. We've got someone like that. Here's where we start to get into it being less clear how this really functions or functioned as a system, and what all the roles are in terms of what's happening. There is some kind of state, it seems, but there also probably, at least as this is imagined, is some vestige of a Goel Hadam type system or a Ziknei Ha'ir, that there's some people who are sort of either responsible for avenging certain people or for maintaining some kind of public order. And they would quote unquote bring the case, at which point sort of the judges seem like they are involved, right? Part of what you see in the language of someone can start to present something, but then they can't back off. There's some kind of blending here between district attorney and judge, right? That is to say, they are trying the case, and jury for that matter, right? They are trying the case, analyzing the case, thinking about points of law, assessing points of fact. They don't have the same kind of division of roles that we necessarily have. And for those of us who've been doing Dinei Mamonot Bishlosha, the previous chapter, Zeborer, we see there too, right? There's some degree of mixing between those different roles. Great. Just seeing some other things that were chatted here. Yeah, I thought that too. The question of doesn't it encourage you to stay silent until you're absolutely certain he's innocent? That's a dynamic we'll want to watch and think about here. I think this is a great place to sort of note, it's impossible to, any prosecutor who read this Mishnah would say, well, seems to me you don't really want to ever execute anyone, right? This is not a normal set of rules where you could pull off any kind of reasonable pace of execution, because everything is so sort of hamstrung in terms of what you can present. The question is, how tendentious is that? How much is this evidence of the fact that this is a non-operative framework, and we're really playing out values here that are not actually about statecraft? Or, you know, the other thing I think we have to think about is how much there is a literal deus ex machina here, which is to say there's a kind of conviction that, well, God will take care of the really bad people. And the job of the judges is to actually only execute people when it seems there's no other way of looking at the evidence and no other way of dealing with the responsibility that has fallen to us. But it is not the responsibility of the court to actually maintain law and order, as it were, the way we think about that today, okay? Stevie says the witnesses initiate a case. Yeah, depends what you mean by initiate, right? In other words, if the witnesses are the one who are gonna give the testimony that's gonna kick it off, are they the one bringing the case? Or are there people saying, hey, you're a witness? We'll get to that verse later on that's gonna indicate that witnesses are summoned sometimes against their will, okay? Great, we'll keep on. We'll come back to some of these great questions in a little bit, including other practical ones. Well, what if the trial lasts more than a week, and how do you deal with that? Great, okay, let's move on here. Again, we're just getting a big picture. We're gonna come back in greater depth to all of these Mishnayot as we go through the chapter in the Talmud. Okay, so here we go, Mishnah Bet. That's one of the longer ones. It's only five Mishnayot in the chapter, but the first and the fifth are doozies. Okay. Dinei hatumot vehataharot matchilin min hagadol. Dinei nefashot matchilin min hatzad. So here we have another difference. When you're dealing with a case of tum'ah and tahara, and you can probably extend that to isur veheter, that is to say the court is deciding a matter of ritual law, then you begin by asking the most senior member of the court his opinion. Whereas in Dinei Nefashot, you start from the side. Here we have a reference to the geographic sort of logistical layout of the tribunal, which we'll get more details about in a minute. But the notion that someone sitting minatzad is going to be more junior. And that is where you are going to begin, probably on the assumption that junior people are going to be nervous about contradicting their seniors. And you're okay with that, when it's a matter, maybe even prefer that, on matters of ritual law, where being strict is a safer position. Dinei nefashot, you want as much possibility of exoneration as you possibly can have. Hakol k'sherin ladun dinei mamonot, ve'ein hakol k'sherin ladun dinei nefashot, ela kohanim, leviim, v'yisraelim amasiin lakeuna. So here we get another restriction of who's eligible. Anyone, now we're going to have to interrogate that anyone in the Talmud, but anyone is valid to judge civil law. So it can't mean anyone, but it's some set of people larger than Kohanim, Levim, Yisraelim, Amasiin, Lakuna, who are the only people fit to serve as judges in capital cases. Now, what does that mean? Well, Kohanim, Levim, Yisraelim seems like it's everyone, but it does not include people who convert, people who do not have a tribal lineage, basically, in one way or the other, or any number of other people who are potentially invalid to marry into the priestly class because of some flaw in their lineage. So here, we see some other notion here where the people who are serving as judges are not just fact finders, right? They are clearly engaging in some sort of communal responsibility taking for this procedure, and therefore their pedigree matters in a way that is totally separate from the just sort of fact-finding and accuracy piece that seems to be at the backbone of the other stuff, okay? Yeah, Dinei Tuma stuck right in the middle here of Mamonot and Nefashot is a little odd, but they're playing out some of the other differences. Yeah, another interesting question, how can a Kohen who is forbidden from being involved in death in terms of coming near to it, be involved in an execution? Yeah, the direct answer would be, well, he's not present for the actual execution, and therefore is just a part of the decision-making body. But you raise an interesting and deeper question about what it means for the Kohen to be straddling these worlds of life and death. Okay, now we're moving on to what does the Sanhedrin look like? Any other, just to pause here for a moment, any other comments or thoughts just on the procedural piece that we're dealing with here before we get to a little bit of what it looks like actually in the Sanhedrin room, which we'll get to in a second. Great. Yeah, ritual issues outside the temple, there's tons. First of all, they're still living in a time. Some of these Mishnayot may be early in the sense that they may still really have to do with things that are going on in the time of the temple. But even before, even after the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, plenty of people are working with actual live, lived Tumah and Tahara. But again, it may also be a way of talking about the category of Isur V'Heter more broadly, which is to say, things that are forbidden, permitted, what's kosher, what's not, various other things of that sort. Great, okay. Let's keep going on now to the next Mishnah. All right. Sanhedrin haita kachatzi goren agula. Kedei sheyihu roin ze et ze. They're in a semicircle so that they can see each other. Ushnei sofrei adayanin omdin lifnehem. Echad miyamin ve'echad mismol. Ve'chotvin divrei hamezakin ve'divrei hamechayvin. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Shlosha, Echad Kotev Divrei HaMezakin, Ve'echad Kotev Divrei HaMechayvin, Vashlishi Kotev Divrei HaMezakin, V'Divrei HaMechayvin. So they're in a semicircle, but there are then also these other folks who are in some kind of secretarial role. There are two secretaries that sit there, one on the right and one on the left, one of whom writes down all the words of the people offering zechut, offering arguments in favor. So in a capital case, that would be exoneration, and in a monetary case, it would be sort of in favor of the defendant against the person trying to get the money out from them. Rabbi Yehuda, however, and then someone writing down all the people offering exculpatory evidence or trying to say that the defendant does not need to to pay. But Rabbi Yehuda says there should be three people, one of whom is going to write down the mizakin, one's going to write the mechayvin, and the third is going to write both of them. All right, that seems to be that there's some notion Rabbi Yehuda wants some corroboration of the record. We can ask the second order interpretive question of whether, why doesn't Rabbi Yehuda have four people? Probably there's just a limit of how many people he thinks the court can deal with. But here we get filled out a little bit of a picture of who else is in the courtroom. And then a picture of how they sit. V'shalosh shurot shel tamidei chachamim yoshvin lifneihem. Kol echad ve'echad makir et mekomo. Hayu tzrichim lismoch, somchim min harishona. Echad min hashniya, balo larishona. Ve'echad min hashlishit, balo lashniya. Uvoririn lahen, od echad, min hakahal, umoshivin oto bashlishit. So there are three rows of talmidei chachamim. So these seem to be people who are learned. They know about the law. They are being trained in some way, but they are not yet judges on the tribunal. Now here we have clearly jumped to exclusively talking about, and maybe we were in the previous Mishnah too, we are clearly here exclusively talking about a capital case, okay? You know, if you read like the descriptions in the Christian Bible of being brought before the Sanhedrin, and there being some kind of room in the temple and where people are sitting, this is sounding more like that. There's some body that has some kind of capital authority in some way that is deciding things. By the way, as a side point, those are interesting and important sources for thinking about capital authority, where it seems like there may sometimes have been some hybrid where Jewish courts were delegated by the Romans to decide whether there were certain kinds of people who merited some kind of death penalty on the part of the Romans, and then the Romans would carry it out. But in any event, here we've got multiple roles. This is not some standard court of three. A court of three deciding a monetary case is not gonna have three rows of students sitting in front of it. Everyone's got their place. If they need to, lismoch, so literally to do smicha, but here it seems to formally elevate them to a place on the Sanhedrin. So you take someone from the first row. This is a very rigid pecking order. And then someone from the second row, who's in the most senior seat in the second row, comes up to the first row. And someone from the third row comes to the second row. And then they pick someone else from the kahal. So the larger community, maybe there's other people hanging out in the courtroom who are not in the rows, they're not even Talmidei Chachamim, but they're Talmidei Chachamim in training. Are they wannabe Talmidei Chachamim? Is this like Rabbi Akiva shows up knowing no Torah and he gets to be a backbencher for a while? Not clear exactly what happens. That person is then sat in the third row. Moshivin oto bashlishit. Ve'lo haya yoshev bimkomo shel rishon, ela yoshev b'makom ha'ra'ui lo. And clarifying, it's not like he sits in the seat that was just vacated, because that is the seat of the most senior person in the third row, who has just moved up to the second row. Rather, he sits in the place worthy of him, which is to say, the last seat in the row, and everyone else moves up. Okay. Now, that gives us a picture of what's happening in the court. So I'll pause there again if there's any thoughts or questions on this. We got a comment here. Isn't there an idea of seven rows in a famous Gemara in Bava Kamma? Yes, the story of Rav Kahana. There you have what a lot of scholars have pointed out seems like it's a description of the Gaonic academies, where you have some kind of seven row structure. I will say, even though we've got Talmidei Chachamim here and there's a blending perhaps of the learning and jurisprudential environment, this is not an academy, right? This is a court in some kind of a way. And so it doesn't seem like we're telling the same story. But here too, as scholars have asked about that story in Bava Kamma, does that reflect anything that was real in the Talmudic period, or is it a retrojection of what it looked like to the late editors of the Talmud to imagine where the Amoraim sat? This too is a question of how much is this a reality for whom at what point in time? Like, are we imagining something from a temple period? Are we remembering something from a temple period? Are we actually imagining that in Usha and Shfar'am and other places where the Sanhedrin moved, that it had this? So you can ask in Yochi Brandes's book, Hapardesh Shel Akiva, The Orchard, she certainly imagines that some of this structure continues to exist in that time. And she's basing it in part on Mishnayot like this. Yeah, is there some deeper significance to the moving up? We can see that when we get to the Gemara, possibly what it may be. And we don't get clarity on the number of people in each row. And we'll see the ways in which eventually in the Gemara, we may get more insight on that. Right now, we're trying to just sort of get the big picture impression of what does this feel like and what does it mean in terms of things that are being communicated here. And it's very clear hierarchy plays a very important role here, right? That seems very clear. Another question here about what sorts of dinei mamonot would be severe enough that they rise to the level of Sanhedrin. I would say none, probably. that is to say, the Sanhedrin would generally only have been a dinei nefashot tribunal. But the question of a Beit Din of 23, which you saw was the number that we got at the beginning earlier, is not the same as the traditional number of 70 or 71 that would have been on the Sanhedrin of the Beit Din Hagadol. In rabbinic, again, imagination or report, every region had a sitting Sanhedrin of 23. So in that sense, they're functioning as sort of, you know, district criminal courts. And then there's some kind of Supreme Court that sits in Jerusalem that's got 71 that deals with the most difficult kinds of questions. So let's continue on now with Mishnah He, which is long and famous, and I imagine many of you have encountered it before, but sort of takes stock of what it's contributing to the discussion. Ketzad me'aymin et ha'edim al edei nefashot. So this, for those of us who did the third chapter, we had a Mishnah there that said, let's refer back to it here, was Ketzad bodkim et ha'edim. Our language there was, how do you check the witnesses in a civil case? And here you have the language of iyum, threatening, putting on warning, putting on guard, probably best translated as scaring the heck out of. How do you do that with witnesses who are coming to testify in a capital case? You would bring them in and sort of conduct the iyum as follows. Shema tomru me'omed, umishmua, eid mipi eid, umipi adam ne'eman shamanu. Well, the first thing I want to know is, hey, are you coming in with omed is probably best translated here as with circumstantial evidence. That is to say, your witnesses, but you are reporting your sense of what it seems to you had happened. Or you heard from someone else. Shmua is hearsay. Eid mipi eid is a specific kind of hearsay. Maybe you heard someone else testify about this in another court, but you are not a direct eyewitness to the act. Or, yeah, it's hearsay, but from someone who would never lie. It was an Adam Ne'eman. They're totally trustworthy. Because if it's any of those things, you have no business being here. Those seem to be sort of procedural attacks on them, preemptive attacks. Hey, do you understand what's the standard of evidence that we need? O Shema Iatem Yodin Shasofenu Livdok Etchem Bidrisha V'Chakira. And maybe you don't get just how rigorous the investigation of your testimony is going to be. And that seems to be a threat against someone who is not being sloppy, but is potentially lying. Do you understand? We are going to get to the bottom of this. And then, to the extent we find that you have been plotting to kill the person, the din of Edim Zomemin may be lurking in the background here, that conspiratory witnesses themselves are put to death. Hevu yodin shelo kedinei mamonot dinei nefashot. And now we switch to you better understand the gravity of what's going on here. And here now the Mishnah takes really from a halachic to an agadic turn. You want to know the real difference between dinei mamonot and dinei nefashot? It has to do what happens to the person who is wrongly decided against. Dinei mamonot, adam notein mamon umitkaper lo. Dinei nefashot, damo v'dam zariyotav tiluyin bo ad sof haolam. If you get a monetary case wrong, or if you lie on some level and make someone pay out of pocket something they didn't own, you just pay back that amount and you're atoned for. Whereas dinei nefashot, your blood, the blood of the person you wrongly killed, and the blood of all of his descendants are hanging above you until the end of time. Shekein matzinu v'kain sharagat achiv, shenemar dmei achicha tzoakim, eino omer dam achicha, ela dmei achicha, damo v'dam zariyotav. The plural use of dmei, which is really just the grammatical plural of damim, like maim, damim can just be a sort of plural verb, plural noun, but because the word dam is also used in smichut form in the Torah, dmei then becomes something worthy taking note of. And the idea is that a person has more than one pint of blood, not just in them, but in their bloodline. And you are accountable for their bloodline. Dmei achicha, so akim, and that pasuk is invoked here to indicate the gravity for the witnesses. Davar acher, dmei achicha, shehaya damo mushlach al ha'itzim ve'al avanim. Alternatively, read dmei achicha to mean that there was blood everywhere. Cain didn't just kill him with a self-cauterizing bullet, but actually destroyed his body and caused him to bleed such that his blood was all over the trees and the rocks all around. What does that have to do with what we're talking about? Nothing. It's just another drasha on Dmei Achicha, which shows us the ways in which the Mishnah in general, but also this chapter, is built out of all kinds of pre-existing components. This is a little midrash unit on Dmei Achicha that is associated here, memorized, and put into the package. And now, on some level, this is part of the Iyum, but it almost feels like the Mishnah is breaking the fourth wall here and speaking to us. Lefichach nivra adam yechidi. This is why human beings are created singularly, meaning the first human being was created single. We'll come back to that in a minute. Breshit Aleph doesn't seem like it. But nivra adam yechidi, to teach you what? Lelamedcha, shekol ha-me'abed, nefesh, achat. And now, in all the printed editions, Mi Yisrael, we'll come back to that in a second. Ma'ale alav ha-katuv ki'ilu ibed olam male, v'chol ha-mekayem nefesh achat Mi Yisrael, ma'ale alav ha-katuv ki'ilu kiyem olam male. So the main reason is, or the first reason why human beings are created singularly, is to teach you that anyone who kills one person has killed an entire world, because once the world was only populated by a single person, and that was the entire world. Okay, it's quite plain from the move that's being made there that actually the word Mi'Yisrael makes no sense in the Mishnah here. That is to say, both in terms of the logic standing behind it, it's really about a human being, but even exegetically, it is harking back to Adam HaRishon, who, whatever he was certainly no Yisrael. And indeed, the early manuscripts of the Mishnah all lack the word Mi'Yisrael. That was clearly a later addition. We can understand all kinds of reasons why that word would have been put in. We're at the end of Yom HaShoah right now. And I'll just say, as sort of a sidebar, one of the most profound things I learned from one of my teachers across the years, Rabbi Morris Shapiro, was a rabbi who served in, he grew up in Poland, went to Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin, was a well-known Ilui there, ended up coming to America, served as a rabbi in Waco, Texas, He sat for many years in the Beit Midrash of the Jewish Theological Seminary. When I was doing my doctorate there, I had a chance and the privilege to interact with him a number of times. I'll never forget him saying that texts in Chazal, he was talking about another one with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Atem Kruyim Adam, Ve'enu Mota Olam Kruyim Adam, but texts broadly in Chazal that dehumanized Gentiles were the texts that got him through the camps. He said the only thing that enabled him to basically go through the terrors of the Nazi regime was to basically feel that he was not actually being tortured by human beings. Because had he had to confront their humanity, he never would have been able to come out the other end of that experience. And then, as was characteristically his way, he said, and now that I've been through that experience, it's of course forbidden to ever talk that way, even from within the Jewish tradition, because that leads to the very dynamics, once you have power, that potentially create, God forbid, the kind of dynamics that that he was the victim of. So I always, whenever I come across texts like this, I always think about, like, what was the role that a text like this played in people's lives in critical moments? Why did someone add it in? Even as we also have to remember, both for historical accuracy, but for, I think, the values we want to stand by, that it was not originally in there, and it doesn't make sense for it to be in there, both textually and values-wise. So in any event, that's the first thing the witnesses are told. Human beings are singular because they contain everything, right? They are of infinite worth in that way. V'chol ha-makayem, sorry, and now going on. Umipnei shlom ha-briyot, shelo yomar adam l'chaveiro abba gadol me'avicha. And so, in order to promote harmony among human beings, so that no one will say, I come from a more distinguished line than you. That is to say, all human beings are equal. And you can't get the kinds of, whether they're arguments based in race theory or other things, that will argue that actually human beings come from different stock and therefore have a different ultimate worth to them. And this you can hear, right? The witnesses are sort of, they're countering the potential mindset of a witness who is sloppily offering testimony to execute someone by thinking, how important is this person? Or this person is from a lesser important class, or any number of ways that they can be marginalized. No, you should not do that. Now, this next point is actually not really about the witnesses at all. And here's where we feel also units being stitched together. The other reason is, if you had the creation of two people, five people at the beginning of time, you would naturally be drawn to a mythology and a cosmology that sees different gods creating competing human beings. And so actually there's something theologically at stake with a human being being singular. Just to jump back, what do you do with Breshit Aleph? I mean, that's a textual problem, right? Breshit Aleph, it seems pretty clear, Zaharu Nekeva Bara Otam. There's two people created at the beginning. And Breshit Bet, you have first the man, then the rib, then the woman. You have to deal with that on its own terms. But here you see there's something also more fraught than just the textual piece. This, I think, can help you understand Chazal's embrace of what seems to have been a certain Platonic idea that the first human being was androgynous, right? The first human being actually had male and female somehow fused into one being. That's the sense in which it was Zachar u'Nekeva bara otam. There was a singular human being that was both male and female. And then Breshit Bet should be read not as removing a rib, but a tzela, uletzela hamishkan, a side of the human being, split in two. The Midrash says literally like with a saw, right? God sawed the human being in half. In any event, gives you a sense there's not just something exegetical going on in that Midrash, the desire to make the first human being one, even if it means messing with some of the gender clarity of Breshit Bet, has theological consequences here as well. And to show how amazing God is,
that
When the U.S. Mint makes a coin, all the coins come out the same. But when the Divine Mint is operating, it's the same stamp, and yet there are totally different people who come out, which is to say, the next claim here is the other thing about human beings is they are each unique. Lest you think as a witness, whatever, dime a dozen, this person can be replaced with that person. No, that doesn't work either. And now again, breaking the fourth wall, kind of in talking to us, lefichach kol echad ve'echad chayav lomar bishvili nivra ha'olam. If you really take to heart the notion of being unique and perhaps going back and of infinite worth as well, then you understand that actually totally makes sense that the entire world would be created just for you. Now going back to the witnesses, v'shema tomru, if you say perhaps, malanu v'latzara hazot, well, now you convinced me, it doesn't seem like a great idea to testify in capital cases. I got a lot to lose and I'm not sure what I have to gain. That the Torah in Vayikra He indicates that if you have testimony and you withhold it, essentially, if you are subpoenaed by the court, you are in contempt of God. And therefore, though the responsibility is heavy, that is not intended and not really giving you license to duck it. You got to bear that responsibility. But we want you to understand that you not only have to tell the truth, but you have to be very careful about what you're saying. V'shema tomru, malanu lachuv bedamo shel zeh, unless you be afraid, not just, you know, I'm going to get in trouble, but, oh my God, like, who am I to execute this person? And here's where the Mishnah takes a sort of surprising turn here at the end, right? The anti-capital punishment people, I think, so far would read this Mishnah and feel great about almost every turn. And lest you go to the last thing and say, I don't want that person's blood on my hands. Even if it's 100% right, at the end of the day, created in the image of God, they're of infinite worth. I don't want that on my record. Now, there is joy in the destruction of the wicked. Okay? Very different kind of sentiment to certain kind of at least in certain quarters, Christian approaches to thinking about capital punishment. The Mishnah here, I think, in an almost exquisite way, and in a way that really characterizes rabbinic thinking in general, kind of refuses to eliminate the dichotomy and the tension. This entire slew of Mishnayot that has been all about capital punishment is radioactive, it's dangerous, etc. At the end of the day, we'll also say, yeah, but you know what? If it is actually done right, there is an aspect of justice here that actually does something positive for human society. Now, we can put aside the question of whether that's actionable in any way. I've already suggested to you, I think the whole chapter here is suggesting that it's not really actionable or revealing that it's not actionable. But there's an aspect here that it's saying, when we think about the values here, the notion that it's just sort of neutral, whether someone really deserving of execution gets it or not, the Mishnah resists that as well, even as it's clearly terrified of kind of procedural abuse when it comes to carrying that out. Okay, let me pause there. I have one other text that's like a supplement to this that I wanna share also. But any other thoughts or ideas here? We got a bunch of chats here, I'll see, that propped up as we were doing some of this. Great. Does the Mishnah encourage us indirectly to come to a certain conclusion, but it may contradict Torah law? I don't know if you want to chat another comment on that. I think it's from Yonatan. The question of what you mean that it contradicts Torah law. I think they would say, you can chat while I'm saying, they would say, no, the Torah just says, the Torah actually says two things that are very important to them. One, v'darashta v'chakarta heitev, make sure you've got it right. So they feel like we're doubling down on doing that very seriously. And then the Torah also says, and if it all checks out and you have the power and all of that, then you should execute someone. And I feel like where they're kind of holding fast with the Torah clearly having place for capital punishment in its system is in that last line, right?
that actually you can't really say malanu lachuv bedamo shel zeh. You can say, I'm not sure I'm right. You can say, I'm only 95% certain and that's not good enough. You can say, we haven't spent enough time thinking about this. To go against the Torah would be to say, that's terrible that we would ever have a notion of execution for anything. But that I think they think is highly tempered by when you have the right and the ability to actually carry that out. It's not so different from the way any number of contemporary voices think about capital punishment, where they'll say, in principle, I can sign on to the notion that this is somehow deserved. And I can in practice say that the system in which we have to carry it out is completely hopelessly mired in bias in a way that makes it actually morally unjustifiable to do it. But you can potentially make the claim that it's morally unjustifiable without claiming that capital punishment itself intrinsically, because it takes a human life, is morally unjustifiable. The difference, great, another comment here on the difference of chova and mamonot and nefashot. Yeah, lachuv bedamo shel zeh makes you into some kind of a rasha in a way that you're not a rasha. There's no rasha. There's no painting someone as wicked in a monetary dispute. It's just who's owed what. So we've got something much deeper here in terms of actually making claims about the values of human beings. One of the things I think is kind of great, and you'll either find this to be, playfully absurd or deeply true, is, right, the Mishnah is like, why were human beings created singularly so that people wouldn't fight? So that people wouldn't have theories about how some people are better than others. Well, that's been a laughable failure, hasn't it? Right? Like, in other words, if that was the goal, that didn't seem to work out so great. So there's an amazing text in the Tosefta here, parallel to this chapter, that I just think, again, I'll let you judge for yourself. Tosefta Perchet, parallel. Adam Nivra Yechidi. Right, human beings created singularly. And this seems to be, by the way, a sort of earlier packet of traditions that are folded into our Mishnah. Like, this actually just seems to be a Gadic material reflecting on why were human beings created singularly. V'lama nivra yechidi ba'olam, shelo yu tzadikim omrim anu banav shel tzadik, v'shelo yu rasha'im omrim anu banav shel rasha. All right, so that's first an interesting thing. You are both worried that people who are righteous will say, well, I just naturally come by that. Like, I'm descended from righteous people. So that's the way I'm going to be. And they maybe doubt their capacity to do wicked and do evil in the world. And so too, Rishayim might say, what do you want from me? I come from a rotten line. And they won't understand that they can actually change. Right? So you can change for good and for bad and understand that, because we all come from the same stock. Okay, next part is what I love. Davar acher. Lama nivra yechidi? Shelo yehu mishpachot mitgarot zo bazo. So that families, or maybe better described, clans or social divisions, won't fight with each other. Look how much people fight now. Imagine if human beings had not been created singularly, how much worse it would be. Davar acher. Lama nivra yechidi? Why is another reason they're created singularly? Mipnei achamsanin ve'agazlanin. Because of people who steal. If you really took seriously that you were related to every other human being, you wouldn't steal from them. Like, you wouldn't steal from your kid. You wouldn't steal from your sibling. All right, that happens too. But you wouldn't do that, by thinking that person's someone else. So I'm getting something for me from them who is not me. Just imagine how much worse it would be in terms of theft and not respecting other people if, in fact, people had not been created singularly. Again, I think there's something there that you can sort of say, that's ridiculous, right? It's like one of my friends telling me, right, if you have a banana, you'll have a better day than you otherwise would have. So it's actually unfalsifiable. If you have a terrible day, like, it might have been worse. That's the silly reading of it. There's something profound here, I think, that also hints to the kind of pointing us towards the values that they're at here, I don't think this is really a statement of the world will be this way because we have this story. It's more our commitment to telling the story of a world that was created with a first human being, despite all kinds of other narratives that the Mishnah is not contending with of, you know, whether it's evolution or other stories that we can tell that explain sort of what our world is about. The commitment of reading in shul, now at home, hopefully by Parshat Bereishit it'll be in shul, a story where it starts out with a single human being is meant to do something in the world. It's actually meant to affect how people behave. That maybe is most important in the courtroom at the moment where people are potentially being killed. But it is clearly a lesson that these sources are pushing out further. Great, some other interesting comments, hope people are looking at here about juries and other ways in which this kind of comes into to our life in various ways. Question, are corporal cases considered dinei nefashot? So the first chapter of Sanhedrin gets into you know, what requires a court of 23, and things that might lead to killing someone are generally put in dinei nefashot, even if the category itself is not fundamentally about executing people. This is where I think you see, I assume the question is coming from a place of, well, if you're just beating someone, then all of this sort of ultimate stuff about taking a life is not on the line. That's where you see a little bit of the crossover here between what actually is being narrated to the witnesses and some material here that's just about sort of the singular and outstanding ontological nature of the human being. So, great. Any, I don't know if any folks from the original living room group, Jed, Sally, anyone else, if you have any comment you want to make. Ariella, you have a-
Yeah, I spent the last 40 minutes trying to find the second Mishnah in the Talmud, and where I found it was right after the first Mishnah with no Gemara in between. You address this, but why is there no Gemara between the two?
Yeah, so we'll get to that when we start the Gemara next time. But basically, what you've got there is the divisions of the Mishnah in the collections of the Mishnah are not always the same as the division in the Talmud. Basically, they divided that up in different ways. There's sometimes where actually the entire chapter of Mishnah appears right at the beginning of a Talmudic paragraph, and then they just do all the Talmud, like the last chapters of Ta'anit function that way. So that just depends on the layout. And sometimes what we have as a single Mishnah in the Mishnayot is split into two in the Talmud. So yeah, that can be different. Okay, great. Well, this is fantastic. Again, we're going to try to find the balance. I would love to hear both keep us on track and learn together, but also get some engagement for what's keeping people on with this. So thanks for being active in the chat. And I look forward to seeing everyone next week when we will jump in to Lamed Bet Amud Aleph in the Gemara itself. Have a great rest of your evening.